From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Amid the grim milestone of more than 200,000 COVID-19 deaths here in the U.S., there is more confusion and skepticism about the guidance from our health institutions. Yesterday, the CDC took down a statement on their website that said that the coronavirus was transmitted through aerosol particles, which experts like Dr. Anthony Fauci say is true. Here is Fauci speaking with CNN's Sanjay Gupta this morning.
And we don't know the extent to which the aerosol component is contributing to transmission. You can make a reasonable assumption, Sanjay, that some aspect of transmission can be and is by aerosol.
So if experts say it's true, are political pressures propelling the continuation of conflicting information from federal agencies? Let's get some perspective from Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We've received a slew of mixed messages from public health institutions about this virus and how it's spread. What's your greatest concern?
Well, my greatest concern is that there have been efforts to sort of downplay the risks. And my view is that these efforts are really being advanced by political leaders and not necessarily technical experts. Clearly, this virus is still very much with us, and we must remain cautious about how we expose ourselves and still take action to protect ourselves. And I want people to understand that message loudly and clearly, despite maybe what they've heard from some political leaders.
And a few things that muddle this message. The CDC, for instance, claims that the statement they retracted yesterday about the virus being transmitted through aerosols was a draft version of proposed changes that was posted to the website by mistake. And the CDC later said that the language will be updated when they completed the changes. But scientists have long said that this is a fact, the way the virus is commonly spread. This feels confusing as to why the CDC has waited so long to say this and is now holding off on making it official on their site.
Yes, I mean, this is an unfortunate situation. And I think were this event to have happened just by itself, it possibly wouldn't be getting the kind of attention that it is getting now. But unfortunately, it follows a series of reports that suggest that there have been political interference in the technical work of the CDC. I do not think this recent event is the result of political interference. I actually think it was an honest mistake where a draft that was not yet ready for prime time was published too early. There's some errors actually in the draft itself, and they certainly needed to be fixed.
You mentioned earlier how political all of this has become. Yesterday, the president gave himself an A+ on his handling of the pandemic amid this really grim milestone in COVID deaths. How is Trump's unwillingness to acknowledge the devastating reality of this virus actually compromising the work of public health agencies to slow this virus?
Well, there still are people that don't believe that this virus is a threat. I mean, I see it here locally. And that's quite unfortunate because we are relying not just on the actions that our governments are taking to protect us, but also the actions of us as individuals. You know, we hope everybody's wearing a mask. We hope everybody is staying home as much as possible. We hope everybody is not putting themselves in situations that could lead to, you know, explosive outbreaks, because the faster we get this virus under control, the sooner we can reopen schools, the sooner we can reopen businesses and the economy more fully. So we really need some clear messaging that we're sort of all in this and we have to each do our part.
Yeah, I mean, this really speaks to the next question I want to ask you about this Axios Ipsos poll published at the beginning of the month that reveals that most Americans think that the government is making the pandemic worse. If we continue getting confusing messages, where are people to turn for accurate guidance? Who should they trust? And really, how can that lack of trust in our public health institutions be rectified?
Sure. Well, I mean, despite the, you know, issues that we've had and the reports of political interference and even some mistakes that have happened, I still very much do think that our government science agencies, the CDC and the FDA and HHS, that these are credible sources of information. Yes, there have been some unfortunate developments, but there's tens of thousands of career civil servants who have, you know, dedicated their entire professional lives for the betterment of the country. And I do think ultimately they will get the information out that needs to be gotten out for sure. But it's not just federal agencies. There's also local agencies. And I actually think that that's an important place to follow for credible and locally relevant information. So your local health department, you know, your local officials, they know what's happening in and around you. And, you know, they're often the place to go to get the most up-to-date and relevant information.
That's Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Well, today, Republican Senator Mitt Romney said he will side with his party and consider President Trump's Supreme Court nominee before November's election. That all but guarantees Republicans will get another conservative judge on the court before the end of the year, establishing a 6-3 majority that could last for decades. Now, Democrats are considering their limited options, including whether to expand the court, add justices if they win control of the Senate in November. Can they do that? Well, it's been done 7 times. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. We always turn to him for historical perspective. And Julian, some people first are surprised that there's nothing in the Constitution that says the president can't carry through this nomination this close to an election that he might lose. And they're also noting that in the Constitution, there's nothing about what the number of justices on the Supreme Court should be. But have we ever seen a nomination this close to an election?
Well, we've seen this before. I mean, Chief Justice Taney died in October 1864 while Lincoln is running for re-election. And most recently, not quite as close, we saw the passing of Justice Scalia in 2016, which is coming back in the news today, when the Senate refused to hold hearings on President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland. So there have been a couple cases like this. And there's also been moments when the court is an extremely contentious issue in electoral politics.
Well, let's talk about that. And by the way, people would say in 2016, that was months before the election, you know, when that became an issue. But I'm doing some reading all the way back to President John Adams and a lame duck Federalist Party. They shrank the size of the court from 6 to 5 to limit Thomas Jefferson's appointments. And then the new majority under President Jefferson restored the 6th seat, expanded the court to 7 seats. So it's kind of fluid. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, until 1869, you see the size of the court fluctuate. As you said, the Constitution doesn't have a number set. That's the responsibility of Congress. And until the 20th century, we didn't have that fixed number. And there have been moments since the 1860s where there have been discussions or efforts to change the size of the court, but it's been remarkably stable. And until now, we haven't had as serious a discussion since the 1930s of changing the size.
Yeah, and what was probably the most noted historical moment when the size was changed, or an attempt?
Well, that's the court packing plan, as it was called by critics of Franklin Roosevelt, when in 1937 he tries to expand the number of justices. He's frustrated that the Supreme Court has knocked down many key New Deal programs. And he makes this proposal, and it does stimulate opposition in Congress. Southern Democrats and Republicans mobilize against them. His conservative critics argue that FDR is becoming a tyrant. And in the end, it doesn't work, although the court itself will change and become more sympathetic to the New Deal.
Yeah. Julian, those in favor of Democrats, retaliating if they win the Senate, say Republicans, haven't won popular elections by and large in the last several elections, and yet they're so able to drastically tilt the court, to this what is presumably going to be the 6-3 divide. Has there been that much of a tilt on the court in the past, and what's the impact of that?
Well, numerically, this is a big one. But if you want to look for a comparison, it's the Earl Warren Court, which in the 1950s and 1960s, under Chief Justice Earl Warren, really pushes the law in a liberal direction on many issues, voting rights, criminal justice, race relations. The court issues a series of decisions that remakes the landscape. After 1962, when JFK has an appointment, the court is solidly in these kind of in this liberal block of a 5-4 vote. And I think we might be entering into a period just like that, but this time the power is on the right.
Yeah. And what's your sense of what Democrats should do, given the lessons of history, if they win the Senate?
Well, I think there's three options. One is to live with it, and there is nothing to do other than contend with a conservative court. The second is to try to move forward with some kind of expansion of the court. And then if there was a Biden presidency, to possibly have the opportunity fill some seats. Or the third would be to work around the court. That's what President Lincoln did, to try to use the legislative branch to counteract what the court is doing on critical issues.
Yeah, pass laws. Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
It was worth the wait to set up our conversation with the Chinese rock star pianist Long Long. He's in Beijing, tough time zone, but as we set up, we realized he had a piano. We're going to get a private concert. Long Long.
Yes.
It's Robin. How are you?
Good. How are you, Robin?
Long Long is known for his hair-tossing, passionate performances of the Romantics like Rachmaninoff. An arm injury in 2017 put him on hiatus for a year. Now his latest project, years in the making, two versions of Bach's masterwork, The Goldberg Variations. One in a studio, one recorded live at St. Thomas Church in Leipzig, Germany, where Bach is buried. An aria and 30 numbered variations written for harpsichord. Many pianists have performed the Goldberg Variations since Bach wrote them in 1741, but for many and for Long Long, Glenn Gould was the standard bearer.
I got deeply inspired by Glenn Gould's version when I was 10 years old, because I often felt as a kid Bach is more academic, less pedal, less rubato, less emotion.
Less excitement.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, but here comes to this incredible Glenn Gould, and he totally lead us to another world of Bach. I really felt that he knows the harpsichord and organ so well, you know. So then he adapted all those great elements from those ancient period instruments into the modern piano. From that moment on, I thought I should also learn how to make sound from the harpsichord.
Did you actually play the harpsichord?
I did. In order to understand this piece, I even studied with one of the best Baroque period instrument musician Andreas Steyr in Cologne. And obviously, we are trying to adapt all the ornamentations, you know, all those things into the modern piano playing.
Yeah.
But I don't want to play a very smooth Bach. I don't want to play a very lighthearted Bach. I want to play a very deep, sometimes even very dark, emotional Bach. I want to show the two sides, not only in the human side, but also, you know, into some spiritual side.
Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah, sure, of course, to be reason 25. I just don't want to play like a very pretty Chopin nocturne.
Oof. And by the way, you play some of these passages, it's been noted, much slower than they've been traditionally played. Like, you know, maybe 4 minutes instead of 10. Is that part of giving it the weightiness that you're feeling?
Partially, yes. Partially not, because I know some people didn't do the repeats. But I did play slightly slower. I want to go as dark, as longingness as possible.
Why? Where did you see that need?
Because that is something that I felt when I'm totally by myself. When you do the real emotionals, then it's actually slower than your heartbeat. And I believe that's what adagio should be.
I'm just wondering, if you were saying you just didn't want to make it light, could we hear one of the more fast-paced passages and then tell us how you interpreted that?
Yeah, like this one. Yeah, for you know, pianists like us, the romantic players, those passages is not real difficult. You know,
so you played them for exercises, right? When you were a kid, didn't you play them for exercises?
I was never worried about that. Yeah. I mean, like this. And this is really not. I mean, it's difficult, but it's not impossible. For me, the most important ones are all the slower ones. I mean, this is why it took me such a long time to do. I'm talking about the aria. And I'm also talking about variation 13. And I'm talking about variation 15. For me, this is a totally harpsichord piece. I'm also talking about this one. The reason it's so difficult is that all those passages, you have to have very searching type of sound, searching for love or searching for the answers, searching for the right direction, and just keep following the shape of the counterpoint. For me, it's much more taking the time to digest and to really get into it. Because I listen to a lot of Goldberg variations, and there are some great ones. But most of some of the recordings, particularly played by the younger generation, I just don't feel there's enough life experience. And I don't feel there's enough strugglingness. It's very often felt too smooth. And then I think too smooth is a not good word for Bach's music.
I was going to say, it doesn't sound like you would have been mature enough to play this 20 years ago and also hadn't had life experiences like injuring your left hand and thinking maybe you weren't going to play again.
That helped a little bit, yeah. But I hope this is not a something that is ideal.
I'm saying you needed to go through some setbacks like that. It would seem.
Yes,
it sounds
it
like
is,
before
it
you.
Is,
yeah.
Yeah.
The variation 30. You said you really, again with the same thinking. You had to have reason. You had to have a level of emotional attachment, and you actually read the folk songs, the German folk songs this was based on, and has to do with family and home.
it's a family reunion song, and I think Bach was giving this piece as the last variation right before the aria comes back. So it's kind of like coming home. And he was talking about the cabbage soup that his mother is making. Yeah, like, so I can play a little bit. It's three different folk song. Now, second one. Yeah, this is the cabbage soup. Very warm, and I remember when I was playing this piece at the St. Thomas Church next to Bach's grave, I was looking into his grave and get so emotional. I can't control myself, you know, my emotion. Everything is just kind of a flashback of knowing his music.
Well, we've had a little bit of our own right now. just... Beautiful. Pianist Long Long, thank you so much for sharing with us some of what was behind your new recording of the Goldberg Variations. Long Long, thank you.
Thank you so much. And also I want the Goldberg Variation. It's a life dream for me. And I have especially this time, you know, with the coronavirus time, I know it's very difficult for every one of us. And I want to send my love through the Goldberg Variations for you.
As the first woman of color on a major party's presidential ticket, Kamala Harris is facing subtle and not so subtle personal attacks that white men would not likely experience. As KQED's senior politics editor Scott Schaefer reports, women's groups are gearing up to defend her.
Shortly after Joe Biden announced Kamala Harris as his running mate, President Trump portrayed her as an extreme liberal who would support what he called socialized medicine. And he said this about Harris's role questioning Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh.
She was nasty to a level that was just a horrible thing the way she was.
Before Harris was announced as the pick, Fatima Goss Graves, president of the National Women's Law Center Action Fund, helped found a group called We Have Her Back. Their goal? To watchdog media coverage that relied on racial or gender stereotypes.
That leans into things like their likability, what they're wearing, their looks, whether they are too ambitious.
Exhibit A, conservative commentator Tucker Carlson on Fox, who said the issue wasn't Harris's race.
America is indeed ready for a black president. We elected one twice. But is America ready for a shallow, hectoring rich lady whose only real fans work at hedge funds and MSNBC?
Carlson also seemed to deliberately mispronounce Harris's first name. Fatima Graves notes that deliberate mangling of Kamala is quite intentional, and Carlson's not the only one doing it.
You know who's further left than crazy Bernie? Kamala. Kamala.
I think that sort of mispronunciation is designed to other her. It is designed to show that she is different, and it is designed to disrespect her. It is for sure racist and sexist.
Now, you might hear that and think women and Democrats are just being too sensitive. But, Graves says,
it sends a message to other women candidates. It sends a message, frankly, to young women of color.
Amy Allison, who founded She the People to encourage women of color to enter politics, says those kinds of attacks are aimed at discouraging women from participating in politics.
When there's an attack on Kamala Harris, there's an attack on 38 million of us women of color, and we're not going to stand for it.
It's a sentiment shared by Alita Garcia, a political activist who works on immigration issues. She says Latinos are often told to work hard and temper their ambition.
It feels like it's an opportunity for all of us, not just for her. It's an opportunity for generations of Americans to see what leadership looks like in a way that is new and is different.
None of this is to say that all criticism of Harris is racist or sexist. Fairly critiquing or attacking her policy positions, her record as district attorney or attorney general are all fair game. In fact, Fatima Graves welcomes that kind of scrutiny.
It's actually not that big of an ask to say when covering women candidates, deal with the substance. Don't deal with the sort of stereotypes and tropes about their looks or likability.
Amy Allison says after the outcome of the 2016 election, she and her allies aren't taking anything for granted.
In just over 50 days, women of color are going to turn out, and we're focused on having the conversation amongst each other about what that's going to take. It's not going to be election day, it's election season.
The goal, she says, is to get women to vote by mid-October and spend the final 2 weeks making sure their friends and families do too. For Here and Now, I'm Scott Schaefer.
Fire crews have started to get the upper hand on some of the wildfires that have consumed nearly a million acres in Oregon. Now recovery is starting to get underway. Aaron Ross is a reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting and joins us now. And Aaron, it sounds like these fires are calming down at least a little. What's the latest on fire activity?
Yes, we got very, very lucky with a pretty significant rain event last week, and that really helped firefighters to get more control of the fires. They were able to make a lot of progress on containment lines and protecting structures, but they caution that these fires are still burning in mm-hmm. pretty widespread. And so at this point, really, it just kind of depends on the weather holding out for us. But if there are high winds, if there's a lot of dry heat, at any point, any of these fires could flare back up again, or new fires that were caused by the lightning strikes from that rain event could also smolder and then erupt.
Sure. Forecasters are warning that people should not let their guard down in Oregon. What does the fire recovery look like? What kind of response are you seeing to people who have been impacted by the fires?
People are finally starting to be able to return to their homes and see if anything is left at all. It looks like they're finishing a lot of recovery surveys. So they've finished search and rescue operations in some areas. They've been able to go through and do inventories of burned buildings in other areas. But the number of structures and homes destroyed just keeps on climbing with every incoming survey. They're finding more. And people are coming together to try to help. There's volunteer yeah. crews working on the fires in Ashland and Talent. But it's going to be a really, really long road to recovery, especially as just hazards like rock fall and tree fall just keep on getting in the way from people who are trying to go home.
Mm. And what does the weather look like in the next few weeks? You mentioned the rain last week helped, but what do we see on the horizon?
In the short term, it looks pretty good. We do have a few more rain events expected this week. Certainly a fair amount is supposed to fall Wednesday through Friday, and temperatures are supposed mm-hmm. to be cool. But when you look at the long-term forecast for the season, it does look like it's supposed to be warmer than normal and maybe a little bit below average precipitation. And it's starting to look like next week we might be seeing a return to these unseasonally hot, dry temperatures. And it's
wow.
still early
yeah.
to say, but we're holding out
yes.
hope.
That's Aaron Ross. She's a reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, fires also continued to burn in California today, where thousands of firefighters are on the front lines trying to protect homes. The average area burned by wildfire in California is 5 times greater than it was 50 years ago. That's according to a recent paper written by climate scientists at Columbia University. The paper examines how human activity and climate change has accelerated fire seasons. Park Williams is one of the authors of the paper. He's part of Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. And Park joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much.
Scientists describe what we're seeing in parts of California and Oregon as mega fires, basically a single fire that burns more than 100,000 acres. Wildfires are common here on the West Coast, but mega fires are a really recent phenomenon, right?
Yeah, they are, at least relative to our modern period. By the middle of the 20th century, we'd gotten very good at suppressing fires on the west coast of the U.S. We had a complete domination over the wildfire regime in the region. And then over the last few decades, we've seen these megafires reemerge. Megafires probably were the norm hundreds of years ago. But we have lost control of the fire regime on the West Coast. And it's not because there are more fires, it turns out. It turns out that it is because the fires that are there are getting larger. And despite our best efforts to put them out, they continue to grow.
And you attribute a big part of this to rising temperatures. Since the 80s, places like California have warmed about 2 degrees Celsius. That doesn't seem like much, but you say this is a big deal. Explain what this temperature change does to the topography of a region.
Yeah, 2 degrees Celsius warming is a big deal. And fire, it turns out, is very sensitive to temperature, more so than you might expect. If you compare a record of temperature in California to the amount of acres and forests that burn in any given year, it turns out that fire and temperature go hand in hand, where the warmer years are the years with more fire. And the reason is the one that you'd expect. A warmer year has drier air, meaning that the air is more able to evaporate water out of soil and out of plants, just the same way that if you warm up your house, then your house plants will dry out. When those plants are dried out, then they become more flammable, and then all you need is a spark and some wind. And it turns out that sparks and wind are not really nearly as limiting of factors as just flammability in California. There's always going to be a spark and there's always going to be wind to carry a fire. So all you really need to do to burn a forest is to dry it out.
What other factors are at play that fuel extreme fire behavior in addition to what you're talking about?
So in developing a hypothesis about why we're seeing the increase in fire in California, it'd be reasonable to hypothesize, well, we've had a big increase in population. That must mean an increase in the availability of sparks to light fires. Mm. Or we have been fighting fires for the last century, and every time we successfully fought a fire, we allowed fuels to continue to grow that would have otherwise been thinned out by the fire. And so today, some of our forests are artificially dense with trees. And so when the fire gets going, you'd hypothesize that the fire should be more intense. So there are all these things that have been changing, but when we look at the data, it's actually surprising to see how strong the relationship is between the area burned and the temperature, the aridity of the atmosphere, and the temperature is the dominant driver.
And since your paper was published last year, we've also seen larger, faster-moving fires in areas where people live. How surprised are you by this?
I'm not surprised. It is definitely concerning. The stories and imagery that came out of Paradise, California, where the campfire burned through an entire town back in 2018, was devastating. But that type of event is more and more likely to occur. Even though it is the warming trend that's driving the propensity for these large fires, the areas these large fires are going to occur in the most are the areas where you have a high abundance of sparks, and that's going to be where people live in California. People are not necessarily lighting fires on purpose, but from their infrastructure, like power lines, for example. Mm-hmm. And those sparks are going to be especially potent to start fires in areas where there are a lot of fuels. And so where you have people living within the forest, then you have a high probability of fire.
Yeah. How do we move past the debate, really, that's happening right now around fire management versus climate change? I mean, fire management is certainly part of the equation, but how can climate change also be centered when we're talking about adapting?
Well, just like any important issue, this one has been really politicized and a false dichotomy has developed. And so it is good that this issue is being discussed. That means that it's being validated as being important. And so that's two steps forward. But now this politicization is definitely one step back, where when we ask why is the increase in fire activity occurring in California and the West, the answer isn't only global warming, and the answer isn't only bad forest management. Both things have been happening, and they both amplify each other. If we were warming the world but we didn't have any forests, then we wouldn't have an increase in forest fire due to global warming. On the other hand, if our forests are artificially dense because we've been fighting fires for a century and we warm the world, then we're going to get a bigger response in forest fire than if our forests weren't artificially dense. But all that said, when we look at the data, the correlation is so strong between temperature and the area of forest burned in a given year. And the two have gone up hand in hand over the last 40 years. And because of that, that has me feeling that temperature warming is the dominant driver of the increase in burned area, and any effect of forest management is a secondary driver.
Park Williams is a climate scientist at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. Park, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks very much for having me.
And this story is part of Covering Climate Now, a week-long global journalism collaboration of more than 400 news outlets.
All eyes have been on the Senate, likely now to confirm President Trump's Supreme Court nominee. But we're also keeping an eye on close House races across the country in our Here and Now District Profile series. This week, Minnesota's 7th Congressional District. The incumbent, the Democratic Congressman Colin Peterson, who doesn't always toe the party line, is facing Republican former Lieutenant Governor Michelle Fischbach. Let's bring in Stephen Montemayor, politics and government reporter at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. Stephen, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And this is a big district. It's along the state's western border. So start by just telling us a little about its voting history.
It's a, as you've mentioned, it's a very large district. It spans from the state's border with Canada all along the border of the Dakotas as well. It's largely rural, and it is voted for Republican each presidential cycle since 2000, often by wide margins, but never by as wide of a margin as in 2016 when it favored our eventual President Trump by more than 30 points against Hillary Clinton. Right. However, Democrat Colin Peterson has been in office since 1991. He still won his race in 2016 and in 2018. However, his margin has narrowed each election since 2014.
Well, and he, as you point out, he's been in office a long time and has always kind of been a bit of an outlier in the Democratic Party. He voted against impeaching President Trump. He also opposes abortion rights. In a debate on WCCO radio earlier this month, he called for more businesses to be allowed to reopen. But here's where he's more in line with his party. He did call for some of the restrictions. Let's listen.
We need to wear masks. We need to wash our hands. We need to socially distance. Keep 6 feet apart, you know, not go to big gatherings. You know, it's pretty simple what works. And so the way to keep these businesses and have these businesses open is to have people follow these protocols, follow the CDC protocols.
So, Stephen, in line with the party there, but not obviously in things like abortion rights, which is about to be a big issue, you know, with the Supreme Court appointee. So what is he campaigning on? How is he threading this needle?
He also, it's important to point out that he often points to his chairmanship of the influential House Agriculture Committee as well. And that is a, he calls that an asset to that district, which again is largely rural, has a lot of farms. And he's also claimed responsibility for passing the, or helping pass the eventual 2018 Farm Bill and his work on the USMCA trade agreement. He's not shy about pointing out his differences with President Trump. For example, he opposes the president's trade wars through the years. Also during that same WCCO debate, proudly touted the fact that he, despite being a Democrat, still earns A-plus ratings from the NRA and has even said that he's gotten higher ratings from the NRA than some of his counterparts on the Republican side of the aisle in the Congress.
Yeah. Well, how about Michelle Fischbach, the Republican, the first female president of the Minnesota Senate? She's praised the president's COVID response. This is where they really differ. He, as we just heard, called for masks. Here she is in that debate speaking about the pandemic.
First and foremost, we need to get things back open and make sure people are back at work, fully reopened and fully back at work. But also, we need to make sure the economy in general is back and we are moving out of that slump. And that means making those tax cuts that the president signed into law in 2017 permanent.
Well, and Stephen, what else is she campaigning on to distinguish herself from a anti-abortion rights you know, anti-impeaching President Trump Democrat.
She and the in the National Republican Congressional Committee, they're going all in on linking Colin Peterson to Nancy Pelosi, and even it's sometimes linking Peterson and his votes to more liberal lawmakers in Congress, such as Minneapolis Democrat Ilhan Omar, which, you know, who in some respects only really shares a party in common with Peterson, given Peterson's support for, you know, many Second Amendment related issues, and also Peterson has anti-abortion streak as well. And I was just recently on the campaign trail with Michelle Fischbach, just a couple of days after Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death. However, the Supreme Court was not really mentioned. A lot of focus has been on defending police, law and order, and returning a conservative to the House Speaker role at some point. Those are really some of the key issues that Michelle Fischbach and others campaigning alongside her are really pointing to.
And just briefly, what do the polls say?
We have seen this race be judged a toss-up lately by some of the, you know, nation's leading election trackers. It's, again, reliably been in favor of Peterson over the last, well, for some time now. But Fischbach's profile, she was recruited by some national Republican leaders in kind of the congressional campaign ranks. And so there's been a lot of interest in this race, and it's going to come down to the wire, it seems.
Stephen Montemayor, a politics and government reporter at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, taking a look at the big 7th congressional district race there. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
So, what questions do you have about voting this year? Let us know at herenow.org. Just click on the cleverly disguised "What questions do you have about voting?" We'd love to hear from you. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.